Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Good day, good evening, and good screaming. I am Jello Biafra, and this is Renegade Roundtable. And yeah, today it's definitely going to be screaming. In some ways, this is an interview I was hoping I would never have to do, because today's subject is Ukraine. Straight from the horse's mouth of one of the main musical war horses, performers, race horses on stage, who is from Ukraine but lives in New York and has a band many of you know and many of you have seen. And if you have never seen this band, don't even bother listening to them first. Just see the whole thing. You know, calling it gypsy punk doesn't quite cover it. So without further ado, the main man of Gogol Bordello, Eugene Hoots.
Yes, thank you, Jello. Thank you. Thank you for quite an intro, yeah.
Yeah, and thanks for being on and all that. Are you on tour right now? You look like you're back home.
Yeah, I just got home. That was the show when you came and saw in San Francisco. Was one of the last shows of the tour. We went up to Vancouver after that and the Seattle and a couple more towns, and then we're back to East Coast preparing for the New Year's run here.
Yeah. New Year's in New York or New Year's overseas?
New Year's here. It's been kind of a tradition that we do East Coast run with emphasis on New York City, kind of
right.
Three nights, New York City, you know, 29th, 30th, 31st. We've been doing it for years, and kind of people fell into that, you know, into a groove with that, with us. And every time we try to deviate from that, they get kind of jittery and upset.
Is it three different venues or just one?
No, we switch up the venues. It's sometimes it's Terminal 5 or Brooklyn Steel, or this time we're doing four nights in Brooklyn Bowl. And the idea is that that way you get to really run the place and call all the shots. It's a residency, you know. You get all the band, you pick all the bands. It's all friends coming to see friends, supporting one each other. You know the vibe. It's just so hard to find that, like, we got them, you know.
If it's Brooklyn Bowl, then is that actually a bowling alley too?
Yes, it is. And not many people going to be bowling during the concerts, obviously, because we kind of arrest the attention. But so it's not so good for their bowling business, but it's great for rock and roll and community. And people love that place, you know, people.
And is it a, do they put a stage on top of the actual bowling lanes, or is it at another part of the building?
Oh, it's a proper concert venue. That's their main thing, is concerts. So it's almost like a more of a side dish theme there, you know. It's
a side dish.
Yeah.
A bowling dish.
Yeah.
Well, you grew up in Kyiv, right?
Yes, Kyiv, yeah.
And do you pronounce it Kyiv or Kyiv?
Well, see, you're already with the times. You're already moving on to the newer, which is original version of it before it was Sovietized and Russified Kiev, you know. But it is Kiev, you know. So
okay.
You're already catching the what's been uncovered and how it should be.
And so when you were growing up there, originally under the thumb of the Soviet Union,
yeah,
and presumably raised to be good Soviet citizens and young pioneers and all that,
uh-huh.
Did you ever think that you would be where you are now?
You know, in some esoteric sense, there was some intuitive vector in my family that was kind of setting that up. It's kind of hard to explain without like getting mystical, you know. And
well, let's get mystical. What created you?
What created me?
Yeah.
Well, that would be forces of the universe, you know, and there's several schools of thought about that. But to get like slightly more back practical, you know, yeah, just there was some kind of germ in our family that, especially from my father, that in a cultural sense, he was a really great English speaking student from the early years. In fact, he went to various republics of Soviet Union to represent, you know, Ukraine as a English, you know, all those kind of language Olympics. And, you know, he was really into music, you know, Little Richard and the works, you know, and Rolling Stones and Doors. And of course, so I grew up like listening to Jimi Hendrix in my mother's womb, you know, like by the time I came out, I already kind of like, by the time I came out of my mom's womb, like I already heard everything that was happening in music by 1972. My dad was on top of this, you know.
And well, how easy was it to stay on top of it inside the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain? How much access did you even have? He obviously had more than most people, I would think.
Exactly. I mean, he was kind of, you know, part of the small movement that was good on digging hard and digging deep. So, you know, their small group of friends, his band, you know, he had a band that called Meridian. And they already kind of were onto that thing, like the door. I mean, there's great pictures of them. They basically look kind of like somewhere between, you know, like New York Dolls-ish, but without the so much glam aspect to it, you know. And it was kind of mind-blowing because it's hard. It's kind of inconceivable, unless I would have these pictures in my family, you know, like, you know.
So, because I was under the impression, and maybe this didn't apply to Ukraine, that everywhere from Russia to the communist Czechoslovakia, it was illegal to play music live in front of anybody, even in your living room, unless you'd auditioned for government bureaucrats who would certify you professional.
Oh, yeah. That whole ridiculousness was in full swing. And but there was, you know, there were loopholes and leeways where people still persevered. I mean, it was small. It was weddings chiefly. You could get away with playing weddings because they're considered to be like, you know, like because everyone in Ukraine has, it's a very rutical country. Almost everyone has family in at the country, in the villages. It's very rare that you find cities that like really have no root back in the village. So, so in a way, in a very kind of unlikely way, but these weddings was like a portal where these small bands could actually go and play something like Doors covers and people go ham to it, you know, and then get chased by the rednecks, you know, we have them too, you know, and get their ass kicked on the way out, you know.
Oh my God.
But
didn't even have to be the police or something.
Yeah, I mean, all those things, you know, they happened in a, like, that's something you don't experience here, but that kind of countryside scene actually allowed for something like culturally, you know, subversive to happen, where people at the wedding would be like, hey, that's like that thing that they don't let that they don't want us to do, you know, like these guys are doing it, you know.
So does this mean that you had the new married couple and all the relatives folk dancing in the courtyard to Tutti Frutti All Rudy or Light My Fire?
Well, actually, not so far from the truth. I mean, if the wedding was, you know, hip enough, sure. But that did happen. I mean, as a little kid, my father dragged me to some of these weddings and, you know, and with him. And or sometimes I would go to them myself because I grew up outside of Kiev in Boyarka. Yeah, my first 5 years I was there. So it's a small village / tiny town. So the wedding would happen. I would just go over there. You know, the guys with the drum set, wow. You know, the guys with the guitars, wow. You know, I would just stand right. Uh-huh. Sometimes I just stand right in the middle of them, you know, like between the bass player and the drummer and just like, you know, take it all in and absorb the vibes and hear them fight with each other.
How old were you? How old were you?
3, 4, 5.
Oh, so you have visual memories of when you were 3 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, they're all from this countryside.
Yes, so do I, but not everybody does.
Yeah. I mean, as a matter of fact, I can match them to some of the pictures that exist from that age. You know, I'd be like, I remember that and vividly, you know. So it was very special, you know.
In my case, my family moved house to the one my mother at 93 still lives in.
Wow.
In Boulder when I was 5 years old. So I have all these memories of the old house.
Wow.
And everything. And then the birth of my sister as soon as we got the new house. And on down the line, picking out my cat I named Squonk when I was 3 years old because she was the only gray and white one instead of a black and white one. But so your father was very fluent in English.
Yeah.
And I don't know how close Ukrainian and Russian are linguistically, where how much of it is actually different.
All right. But this is important.
The question I'm getting to is, how many languages do you know? How many did you grow up speaking and learning?
Well, this is actually a great topic because I love languages and I grew up being exposed to 3 languages. So actually, 4 with English. So that's Ukrainian, that all my grandparents, you know, spoke fluently because they were from countryside, and that's the language they spoke. And Russian because it was heavy Russification, and in fact, everything was. I was just discussing it with my father the other night how he was describing that curve where in the late 60s, early 70s, there was this subtle, invisible curve where everything that was in Kyiv spelled in Ukrainian, all the streets and markets, you know, one by one started getting respelled in Russified versions, and how over a course of decade, it was sort of like, you know, just transformed. You know, boiling the frog in a pot, you know what I mean? And that kind of people didn't think much of it because it wasn't on their radar, you know, and that's such an aggressive form of Russification.
Oh, yeah.
Because in a way, here's the trick, because Ukrainian is such a specific thing to be, so you feel like nothing can mess with your Ukrainianness. So if they would be like, respelling it, I'd be like, oh, they're doing it for, I don't know, for some delegation from DDR that's going to come here. So they probably want to show off and then they're going to paint it back into Ukrainian. That was the kind of the vibe of it. People thought it was a joke. Yeah. And so we're dealing with the consequences of this joke and not taking it seriously at the time. You know, although there were very prominent figures in schools, teachers, who between the lines kept reminding kids to ask kids that this is occupied territory.
Really?
Yes, it had to be very subtle, but because of their archetypal Ukrainianness, you know, they had a way of teaching you, you know, chemistry and physics and swinging in all the Ukrainian proverbs and kind of explaining that, you know, that this terminology also exists in Ukrainian and, you know, so explaining that that's where, that's the root of this, you know, and sometimes they get persecuted and, you know, there were pop stars like that too, and TV hosts. There was a quite strong resistance there, but I wish it was stronger even back then, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But was there some fear with the people, the teachers and others, that at least somebody among them was the Ukrainian or Soviet version of the Stasi in East Germany and the DDR, the secret police who spied on everybody else and even your own family and turn you in? Or was it not that severe?
We did not experience that because we did not experience this. I don't know, I guess because of specificness of our family and friends. I mean, everybody was just kind of in this frame of mind that this whole Soviet Union thing is a fucking joke. You know, that all of this is just some kind of show-off thing for God knows who. This is just show-off for the bureaucrats who come from Moscow and need to put in Dunzo. So they can put in Dunzo, you know, and then get the fuck out, you know. And that was the kind of vibe of how we looked at it, you know, like, you know.
So is, were you using the same Cyrillic alphabet that Russian language uses?
Yes, well, the alphabet is actually Bulgarian. I mean, it's Greek. It's Greek Bulgarian. And it's funny because this summer our tour was routed in such a way that we made a journey without...
Yeah, turn your volume up if you like to.
One second. I'm going to turn up the volume and also plug in the charger.
Pump up the volume.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
There you are. Now you're sideways. There you go.
Is it better if I go like this or no?
Visually, no. You're turned on your side. There you are. But sound-wise, the more we get, the better. That's been an ongoing adventure with these podcasts. It's not always that loud on the other end. So, yeah.
Be prominent sound-wise. So, is visibility okay?
Yeah. You ready for another related question?
Well, I want to speak about the languages a little bit more because it's super important. Um, You know, with the languages, it's interesting that you ask a Cyrillic alphabet that threads, you know, Ukraine, is originated from Bulgaria, from Plovdiv. And amazingly enough, our summer tour was somehow routed. It was not, I don't think it was a Booker's concept, but it was somehow routed backwards into the heart of invention of Cyrillic alphabets, because we went through, we were in Ukraine, but then we were in Bulgaria, then we were in Greece. And the alphabet was basically developed in Greece, in Thessaloniki, and brought by Cyril and Methodius, two monks, Kirill, which is why it's called Cyrillics, Cyril and main monk, in Bulgaria. Then it spread onto Kiev and Rus, which is Ukraine. And then it was borrowed by the Moscovites. And then it was also borrowed into by Mongolia, because they didn't have their own alphabet up until 20th century.
Oh.
Yes.
I did not know that. I just assumed they used a, you know, Pacific Rim type of alphabet with a lot of characters, and I assume that was Mongolian too. No,
they use Cyrillics in a little bit more funky way, you know, and yeah. But the alphabet is birthed in Bulgaria, and that's the kind of, it was a great thriving culture, you know. So was Kiev and Rus way before Moscow even was on the map. Before it even exist.
Right. Well, I think this is going to connect with one of the many psycho excuses Vladimir Putin has used to try and seize Ukraine, even if he has to destroy it in order to make it this bombed out, ruined part of Russia. And that is, I think it was you who told me that the original, Putin claims the original capital of Russia was Kiev, because that was where the Rus originally settled. And where did the Rus come from? Are they descended from Vikings?
Yes, so the way, absolutely, you're right. They try to chop solid all that history into unintelligible medley that suits their, you know, geopolitical needs, of course. But, you know, they basically use mythology as opposed to history or logic in Russia. In Russia, that's how they run the place. It's their number one favorite thing is make their propaganda is absolutely unintelligible, because they are catering to very uneducated population for 90% of it that is absolutely happy to consume all that, because the payoff, they have zero responsibility, you know, for any other actions. And that's their long time history, you know. They're kind of, it's a very successful zombie farm. It's been like that since, you know, they mastered it. I mean, they mastered it for the last 500 years. And, you know, to answer your question, yes, the Vikings came in and settled with and started, you know, contacting with the Slavic tribes on the modern day Ukraine territory. And the word Rus is actually coming from the Scandinavians. So Ukraine is the original Russia. It's the original Rus. Now, that happened for centuries, where it was a successful, thriving, you know, civilization of its own. Then when the Mongol and Tartars invasions, you know, Genghis Khan and all his sequencers came in, they kind of destroyed and taxed heavily Ukraine and all the lands. And the Moscovite kind of appeared as a completely separate entity while all the pillaging was going on. And it actually formed from different tribes. They're not even Slavic. it's Ungar and Finnish tribes. So they're not of Slavic nature. That's another thing that people don't know, don't understand, or just didn't get to it yet. But the huge difference between Polish, Ukrainian, you know, Slovakian, Bulgarian, you know, Slovenian people is that we are actually Slavic tribes. There is affinity as Ungar Finnish tribe of modern day Rus is essentially different in their DNA. And there was that whole like delirious propaganda that Ukrainians and Russians are some kind of brothers separated at birth is a complete load of garbage, you know. It's gonna get undone now because obviously see what happened, you see what happening, you know.
Well, one thing, I guess I didn't get this in you and read it, but it sounds like what I read might not be right. And that is when the Mongols stormed in and took over what is modern day Ukraine, took all the many of the Rus fled north and east from Kiev and then settled down in a sleepy little trading town called Moscow, which grew into the new Russian capital, right or wrong?
It could be said like that. Maybe some of partly of it true. Nobody was there. You know, at this point, it's unverifiable. But that's the myth that they trying to upplay, that there is that connection. But why? There was enough people in that territory where Rus is, where Russia is now, to form their own entities. Like, why did it need to be somebody moving there? There was other tribes living and trying to, you know, make it out of the swamp, you know.
Right. So where does that leave Crimea, which I had at least thought was actually Russian all along? No?
No, it's actually the native population of Crimea is Greek and Tartars. Crimean Tartars, who are closely related with Turks. They're Muslim.
So Tartars and Turkics are two different people then? Or are we all talking all under the umbrella of the Ottoman Empire?
I mean, Crimean Tartars are Muslims. So, you know, it's definitely was, they had a lot of connection to Ottoman Empire. I'm not a specialist on that particular subject. You know, like I more know about the Kazakhdom and their kind of their campaigns,
right.
But it is the Crimea was populated with ex-KGB agents, and during Soviet Union time, it's kind of like a Florida for retired KGB people. You know, that's kind of like what they turn it into, which is why there are so many people speaking Russian. It was a strategic move, you know. They kind of flooded that area with them, and because it is a good place to retire, you know.
Well, where does Nikita Khrushchev fit in?
You know, he's such a controversial figure. You know, some of the things that he did could be seen as positive, you know, because he did debunk Stalin's, you know, glory, you know. But, you know, people were blindly.
Wasn't he Ukrainian or even Crimean or not?
Yeah, I think Khrushchev was partly Ukrainian, yeah. Yeah, I think he was, but, you know, he was, and this is all way before my time, so. You know,
right.
He did have some positive impact, but still, you know, he was a communist, part of the communist dictatorship. So, you know, how good can it get?
The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Yeah.
And stuff. Did he move Crimea to being part of the Ukrainian Socialist Republic, or was it always part of Ukraine? Crimea.
Well, I mean, listen, in that area, everything has been drawn and redrawn back and forth so many times that it's actually, you know, it's actually kind of like, okay, here's a map of 1890. It looks like Ukraine, West Ukraine is part of you know, Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, that chunk. Then, like, literally, you know, a decade later, Austro-Hungarian Empire ceased to exist. So that part goes to Poland, and part goes back to Ukraine, and part goes to Russia. And it's been drawn and redrawn so many times that some people in West Ukraine, it's a kind of a common folkloric thing to say. People say, you know, my grand-grandfather was born in Ukraine, went in school in Austro-Hungarian Empire, got married and had family while he was in Poland, and died when he was in Soviet Union. And he never left his village. You know what I mean? So there has been a lot of fighting over that area for many reasons. I mean, it is right between the pathways of trade between Asia and Europe, you know, and a lot of warfare took place there. But the Ukrainian nation exists as an entity over 1,000 years, you know. The new semantics of it is calling it Ukrainian, you know. But, you know, back then it called Kiev and Rus, you know.
Right.
And so this is something that's very hard to explain to Westerners. You know, it needs like half-hour conversation that people don't usually, you know, have about that. They kind of...
Oh, I know. And then we already had one a few months ago about it, and I was fascinated. So I thought more people might want to know this too.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. You know, I mean, that's part of the mission of punk rock is, you know, to keep it educational, you know, and informational, you know.
Which, so somehow, Little Richard and the Doors at Weddings, which is still blowing my mind. But somehow you didn't just get exposed to your father's music, you got exposed to punk rock.
Yeah.
And were people a little older than you already aware of it, some people, or was you and your friends some of the first?
You know, I did hear about punk rock from my father first, although it was a different... We had a record of Slade, oh, yeah. You know, with their fist sticking out, written Slade here. And this record was, I loved that record as a little kid. It was just so obnoxious and loud and super catchy, entertaining. You know, you just wanted to bounce all over the house to that record. And
Invited all your friends in too.
Such a great record. And so, and my father told me that that's punk, you know? And I was like, okay, well, it does stand out. I mean, if you're listening to Doors and T-Rex, you know, it's just kind of like, wow, this is like a different thing, you know? These guys are on the overdrive, you know?
Yeah.
And then when I started going, you know, I was going to steel metal shows with my father. I was playing drums and just, we had a metal scene in Kiev. It wasn't huge, but it was there. And my dad was really into metal, and he's still in it. Now he's into industrial metal. So like Icebreaker is his favorite band, you know. And and at one time we went and saw to see this metal show, and there was a band that I was like, what are they doing? It's kind of like is kind of as fast as Slayer, but it's not really as technical, and it's more fun, you know. And then people and kids there told me, like, man, that's not mad, that's punk. And I was like, huh, I'm gonna have to look into that, you know. And so then they gave me, you know, so I had older friends, couple kids who went from being metalheads that, you know, their attire was just changing. They used words like, you know, punk and post-punk and hardcore, you know, and I was like, oh, I got to get load of all this. And I start, they start giving me basically more and more of these tapes. Usually it was cassettes on two sides, you know. And one of the things that really blew my mind was Punk and Disorderly compilations.
Huh.
Yeah, they were kind of like, I still look at them as a kind of a Bible of like.
Interesting.
Yeah, which had Kill the Poor, you know, the right. Kennedys, and it had a, you know, Angelic Upstarts and GBH and, you know, the Addicts and the Exploited. And it was just kind of a great selections. And I kind of really got hip to that because it just had such a high energy. And I started hanging out more with the kids who were listening to that than kids with the long hair. You know, that was just kind of like, okay, been there, done that. And now I'm onto this. And the interesting thing, as we all know, about punk and hardcore, it develops rapidly and in quantum leaps. So, you know, I was hanging out with them. They were all had mohawks and leather jackets. And the next thing I knew, like half of them were like, lost all the hair and had barracuda jackets and, you know, and combat boots on. So, yeah, it was, and listening to MOD and things like that. And I was like, okay, this is like, this train is going fast, just like taking notes every week, trying to catch on. And then one thing that really blew my mind was when a band that we both know, Deserter from Poland,
right,
came to Kyiv and played a concert. Now, that was when I first like was went and saw that punk, that Slade is not punk, this is punk.
Right. Like, right.
This is it. Like, this is a different aesthetic. These people have a different body language. It's not about partying. It's about political insight. It's very angry, and energy is through the roof. And Deserter was very impactful because, you know, they sang in Polish, but as a Ukrainian, you know, we can understand Polish pretty tangibly, you know. As I said, it's a Slavic family of things, and they were very radical the way they rolled in into Ukraine. They kind of, the singer made announcement right away that, you know, this song is called Moi Kraj, which means my land, because don't forget that this is like an occupied territory. I was like, what the fuck? This is fucking awesome. Like, nobody has the balls to say this shit on stage here. Of course, the show lasted like 10 minutes, you know. The people came out and, you know, in the uniforms and bolted the show down. But that made it all the impact, you know. That was like, this is punk. I got this. I'm going to stick with this, you know.
Well, the interesting part about this and Deserter and what you're saying about people walking around with mohawks, I'm thinking, wait a minute, in a Soviet satellite, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, people were allowed to have mohawks and didn't get arrested, or did they? Not to mention, if Deserter talked about occupied land in the Ukraine, it means they did it in Poland too. Yeah. And for a long time, this was still Soviet Empire and the Warsaw Pact countries still running the show, I assume.
Yeah.
Communist governments. And somehow Deserter managed to get the monopoly music label. Do you think major labels over here are heavy-handed and bad? And you were in a country, and so were Deserter, where there was only one label. It was the government's label. And somehow, and both the one in Czechoslovakia and in Poland tolerated prog rock because it was formal and people were trained musicians, I guess. I don't know. They put up with that, but not a lot of rock and roll. But then somehow in Poland, they got the government label to put out that 7-inch EP with no cover, which was the debut of Deserter.
Yeah.
And somehow a copy of that got over here to Maximum Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
And then there was just a little bit of freedom of the mail where the occasional letter from a Polish punk would come to me or Alternative Tentacles, and I would write them back and then try to, you know, have any other cool records besides Deserter. And not that long afterwards, there actually were. So things were already starting to loosen. And
absolutely.
One of the Polish labels, it started to have more than one name. I think it was Poltone, actually licensed Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables from Cherry Red. And years after it was released in other countries, we had a domestic Polish release of Fresh Fruit on the government's label.
I did not know
apparently
that. That's amazing.
Cherry Red even got paid at least a little bit.
That's amazing. I did not
know
that.
What's more amazing to me, as I say, is somehow, and I'm assuming in Ukraine, you weren't like getting vinyl records from England or America or anything. You were passing around cassettes that people just dubbed for each other, right?
That was the culture for sure. There was also vinyl. I mean, I did have a substantial vinyl collection. It just took all the money. It's like, you say when lunch money, I mean, like everybody else around the world, except for us, like you had to save for like 3 months to go and buy a record, you know?
Right,
it costed a lot of money. It was like 40, 50 rubles to buy one LP. That's a lot of money. Like, that's 3 months worth of lunch money when you were in high school. But the key to this, as you describe situation, that, you know, it's amazing that people with Mohawks still existed there. I mean, the key to this is that this was CASP time. This was already Gorbachev. So when Gorbachev came, the vibe started transforming. Like, this was not Brezhnev Andropov like time anymore, you know. People start experimenting. Like, in the past, if there would be like a punk concert in somebody's kitchen, literally in the kitchen, like when somebody's parents are away, you know. You know, then people would go up and put up the Irokes, you know, as we call them, the Mohawk, in a hallway and go into the show and then take it down before going back on the subway. But then we started experimenting, like, what if I just go on a subway in it, you know, what's going to happen? And, you know, cops would come up and say, like, hey, what the fuck, you know, like, come with us and, you know, come and abuse you and, shave it off, or, you know, all these things happened. Plus, there was a lot of asshole kind of pro-Soviet youth subcultures called Lubere, just total bully, idiot, fuckhead, commie morons who would catch us on the street and sometimes beat us up, you know, and or shave or give it a trim, you know what I mean? Like, that all happened. So
a little bit like what happened to hippies in Colorado when I was in my early teens, a little bit.
Yeah, these things are pretty global. It's just, you know, in Soviet Union, I think it was just a little different degree of it because it is so highly politicized. And, so because of Gorbachev, things kind of start opening up a little bit. It was still like, hey, listen, it was like a little less illegal than, say, in early 80s, you know?
Right.
And then somehow Deserter would come and a couple other bands, some bands from Denmark would come, you know, that were kind of punky. And nothing big, but something that had that aesthetic, you know, for some kind of youth festival. But bands from Poland, like Tilt and Deserter and who else was there? Another band called Sikira. Another band called Moskva. It was a deeply ironic name. I mean, they were anti-Soviet stuff, you know. And
another one.
They were coming to play several times. And that's got, they were very GBH kind of sound, like DOA, yeah. GBH, Dead Kennedy sounding bands.
Yeah.
So that's when I was really like on that train. Like I figured my way around that thing and start forming bands with my friends that were from that tree, you know?
Right. Well, before we move into you starting your own stuff, which is coming very shortly, I was curious, your father was taking you to metal shows, and were these Ukrainian or Polish or metal bands or from the other side of the Iron Curtain?
No, they were literally from our district.
Right.
Yeah.
And was part of the reason they were tolerated was that they were nationalist or pro-government?
Absolutely not. They were completely...
Metal was used for pro-government purposes by both DDR, East Germany, and Poland.
No, they were... These bands that we were into called Adam and Titanic, and they were a very independent spirit that just guys who kicked a lot of ass and, you know, wore cut-off jean jackets and leather pants and head bandanas and just kicked a lot of ass. Like, they just had that, like, lifer vibe, you know? Like, they didn't give a fuck if they ever going to have a job or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you guys managed to get jobs. Or did you?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't on my radar at all. Like, that wasn't even... This is why I used words like esoteric and mystical in the beginning of our talk, is because I haven't quite cracked that case and panoramic understanding of this, but I'm not making it up. Like, this was literally the farthest thing on my mind that besides music, there is something else to existence. Like, right. I couldn't give a fuck less about, joining university or things like that. Like, I mean, I did pass an exam at university and I just didn't even go, you know. I was like, whatever, you know. You know what I mean? Like, I was completely pre-living. I was kind of on that music. I was a lifer from back then, you know.
Well, luckily you had a family who understood that and seems to have encouraged it too.
Yeah. Yeah. And much respect to that. That means so much, you know. I mean, it's everything. And also, you know, my father, also his brother, you know, his brother is a painter and actually pretty prominent painter in Ukraine, and who was petitioned to do a lot of murals and, kind of very cool historical paintings, and hit a lot of, he finished, you know, Painter Academy in Kiev. So I grew up in in dirty pants with paint everywhere, you know, you know, long hair, art studio, music, you know, rehearsal. I knew that vibe. So, you know, it felt like that's what people do, you know. I mean, I kind of looked, I was like, I guess that's going to be my bubble, you know. That's what I got attuned to, that people who were doing that. And they were hustling, of course.
A family where you still had a place to go home and get food and a bed to sleep in.
Yeah, well, they weren't big places. They were kind of pretty much like shoeboxes, you know. But everybody got along, and I think one of the greatest things that helped me out in touring later on, and in fact, many of my bandmates, is that, you know, touring in early years in a van for like 5-6 years was not a problem for me, because, I mean, not having any personal space was kind of like normal, you know? Like, that's how kind of we grew up. The apartment was tiny and there was 8 people all the time. Like, grandparents, my parents, my mother's brother, his wife, and their son, you know. So it's like,
wow,
that was the vibe.
And it was all mass transportation too, right? No personal cars.
Eventually, yes, of course. Taking buses, subways, all that. That's normal all the time. And eventually, my grandmother, as a veteran of war, was able to, you know, as a, one of the rewards for service during entire warfare of 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, you know, they were able to get a car. But I was already basically almost before we left the Ukraine, you know.
Right. So was skateboards much of a thing for you guys?
You know, it might be that I was probably one of the first kids to ever have skateboard in Ukraine. My father brought it from, I don't know where he got it, maybe from Estonia. We had a family in Estonia. We went up there a couple times because they're so kind of, you know, almost, we thought like Estonia was like going to NATO back then, you know. They were just so fuck Russia back then, you know, that, you know. And so I think he got it in Estonia. It was a skateboard that doesn't fluctuate. It was kind of early models. But I had one. I did not catch on with any movement. There was no movement. People were just looking at me strange, like, why are you doing this? Like, you know, like, what are you doing, man? Like, why are you rolling on a piece of plywood through the street? Like, stop doing that.
Especially if it's cobblestone streets.
Yeah, cobblestone, but it was just, there was no movement for it at that point, you know?
Right.
I did kind of.
But not many cobblestone streets?
We do have that, but at the district where I continued, like, growing up was very industrial and outskirtish. So it's more like Bronx. It's a lot of projects and a lot of pavement.
Yeah.
And not a whole hell lot of anything else.
Right. Well, at some point, to my utter surprise, I think Gorbachev must have been in by then. There was starting to be a little bit of rumblings of even attempts at, shall we say, Soviet punk and new wave on their government Melodia label. And of course, there was more and more stuff coming out of Poland. Armia, however you say that name, that was a favorite. They did a little bit more interesting stuff with hardcore and later metal than some of the others. Brigada Crisis from Poland, who was, you know, almost a space rock band, considered a punk band. And then, lo and behold, Low Means No's manager told me one day, hey, yeah, there's a Ukrainian band who made an album, and they're a punk band.
Uh-huh.
And he got me one.
Right.
And what I really liked about it wasn't just, it didn't sound like a million and one British, Western European, or American punk bands. It didn't sound like anything I'd heard before, because one of the lead instruments, along with the punked out guitar, was an accordion, and they knew how to make it all fit. You knew these guys.
I know exactly who you're talking about, of course.
I need their name.
Well, the abbreviated name is VV. VV.
Right, right.
The extended name is Vopli Vida Plasova. So the,
right,
the,
yeah,
the shout out of Vida Plasov.
Okay, yeah, it was presented to me as VV, but I knew that was just something Europeans and Canadians and Americans put on the band because you weren't even try and say the name, even though it was in the our alphabet on the record cover. It wasn't Cyrillic, if I recall. Maybe not even on the back. Were they a little older than you?
Yes, these guys, I knew them actually before they even formed this band. Not on a deeply personal level, but, you know, I was at the time, I was about 14, 15. And a lot of the guys who I was hanging out with, they were already like 19, 20, 21, and then on so on, you know. So I kind of felt like an intern, you know, in a in the punk scene, you know, and, you know, I wrote for the fanzines and, you know, if they needed, you know, load in, load out, that kind of thing. Like, I was just kind of guy on the fly in a lot of ways before I started getting into my own band. But I actually was asked several times to load in for Vava and or even go across the town because the bass player forgot the bass for the gig.
You know? So sounds like another bass player I used to be in a band with.
Yeah, it seems to be the thing. So I would go. I remember me and my friend were asked to go and get this treasure of a legendary bass because he had this very, it was a very eccentric band. Everything about them was absolutely singular. And the bass player, Sasha Pipa, he had this square bass that he made, I don't know, out of what, out of a fucking chair or I don't know what. It was painted all like stripe and weird. And so it had no case, of course. And we went and got it and we're on the subway going back to the gig. And, you know, people were just looking at us like, what the hell is this? Like, why are these weird looking, you know, kids carrying this snow shovel or whatever it is, you know? That was, of course, very different to what we thought about the situation. You know, we were like, do you even motherfuckers know how in we are on this? We're carrying we're carrying Holy Grail as far as we are concerned. You know, here we are on the subway with a Holy Grail standing here loud and proud. You know, here's the bass of the most badass Ukrainian band and we're carrying it. You know, so.
And how, you know, I know the feeling, believe you me, but that'll eat up all your interview if I tell you 77 Colorado punk stories. Save that for another time. But where you were taking the bass on the subway to the VV gig. How many people would go to their gigs?
Well, you know, several hundred.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not more than 200, but that would consider to be like, because the places were tiny. So,
right.
You know, it'd be like some like college dorm thing or some kind of a theater that was out of circulation, you know, sometimes smaller, sometimes in a factory, there would be like a cultural venue, literally in a factory. So that also happened.
Right, right.
But not a lot, but it was very friendly scene. Like the metalheads and people just went off all different kind of walks. You know, people who listen to like, Communards and, you know, all the like British kind of synth bands would go. And everybody would just kind of do twist and shout to Veve because it was so unifying. It was just good time music, you know, like punk with accordion and in Ukrainian, you know, it was just such a big statement. And another thing is that, you know, they were very legendary when going playing in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, showing them that, you know, fuck off, you know, like we have our own thing. And they became actually totally legendary on that whole territory. I mean, along with us, they've been boycotting them for many years. Of course, there is no turning back. But in Soviet Union time, it was a kind of a mission to go to these, you know, centers of the Sovietness and kind of tell them culturally to fuck off.
So that their gigs, were you allowed to advertise them and put up flyers on telephone poles, or are they all word of mouth?
Word of mouth. And predominantly there was one newspaper that had a cool journalist. His name was Alexander Rudyachenko. And in fact, I kind of worked for him for a while as being a reviewer when I was like 14, you know.
Wow.
I met him and he was like, hey, if you want to like, he was just a hip guy who wanted to be like, hey, listen, like as much as we can report about the scene, between the lines, or I'll work my magic, whatever we can do.
And fanzines somehow got passed around and reproduced.
Yes, well, fanzines, that was another dimension. That was heavy on the print. Like, I was involved there just writing for fanzines. That was one thing, yes. Right. This was actually a one official newspaper where the guy just boiled, the editor bolzed out and was down for the cause. And for a while, I wrote several reviews and, you know, and he was just kind of like, then it all got closed down and kind of fizzled out. But there was a little bit of...
Speaking of closing down and fizzling out, we have come to the end of hour number one, pretty much. So stay tuned for hour number two.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.